Dr. Robert C. Newman, Professor of New Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
Our subject today is the subject of God in the universe. Many people claim that there's no evidence for the existence of God, that the belief in God is merely something that's wishful thinking, not based on any kind of real evidence. In fact, it even goes against the evidence. Some of these people are just the average man-in-the-street type, and they have arguments which perhaps have been used for hundreds of years, no big deal to them. Others have training in the sciences or in philosophy or something of that sort. They use a lot of very complicated terminology, and it's very hard to understand them even. And sometimes we're tempted to think, well, these people are scholars, and they study this thing very carefully, and they don't believe in God. How can I, who have not studied these things, tell them any different? Well, we need to realize that the Bible claims that the situation is really quite different than that. The Bible tells us in Psalm 19 that the heavens are telling us something about the existence of God. Let me read you the passage. Psalm 19, verses 1 through 4. The heavens declare the glory of God. The firmament shows His handiwork. Day unto day utters speech. Night unto night shows knowledge. There is no speech nor language. Their voice is not heard. Their line is going out through all the earth, their words to the end of the world. Basically, the point here is in Psalm 19, verses 1 through 4a, is a disagreement with the common view of many people that there's no evidence for the existence of God. Instead, the Bible tells us that the heavens, the sky, is telling us something about God all the time. It is itself His handiwork. And just as we learn something about an artist by the art he has done, just as we learn something about a craftsman by the work he has done, and even we learn something about a person who might be working for us by the quality of the work they do. So the work which God has done in making the universe tells us something about Him. It declares the glory of God. That is, it declares those things about God that are different from what describe us, what describe other beings in the universe. So the peculiar things about God that others cannot match. This passage also tells us that this information is coming to us all the time. That's coming to us in the daytime, and pictured here in the psalm by one day talking to another. That's coming to us in the nighttime. One night is teaching another by showing it knowledge. And then it says, following the Hebrew here, yet in spite of this, there's no speech, no language. Their voice is not heard. And I think the point there is that the information that the universe is telling us about is not telling us about it verbally. It's not coming to us in Greek or Hebrew or English or something like that. It's telling us in a non-linguistic way. And that has a disadvantage, perhaps in one direction, that might be misunderstood, but has an advantage that it supersedes the language barriers. And so this information is going out to all the world, even though people speak many different languages. So certainly Psalm 19 says that the universe is indicating God's existence, His glory, so that it can be seen by anyone independent of language. Now, Romans 1, verses 18 through 20, go further than this and say not only is it doing this, but men don't want to hear that message, and therefore they are misusing their abilities to study the universe in such a way as to reach conclusions that are different from those that the universe is actually teaching us. Let me read this passage to you. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them. God has shown it unto them, for the invisible things concerning Him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. The picture we see here, then, is God is angry with mankind because certain invisible things about Him can be known by looking at the created world. And we're told what these are. We're told they're His deity, His Godhead, that which distinguishes Him from other beings in general, and also His eternal power, which is one of those things that distinguish Him, but apparently one which is particularly apparent in the nature of the universe. We're told that God is angry with men for this, and that they are without excuse, and yet they are suppressing the truth in unrighteousness. They are using a method to try and avoid coming to these kinds of conclusions. So what we actually see today, then, is there are many people who claim there's no evidence for the existence of God, nobody can know, pick your own God, or don't have any. And the Bible, on the other hand, saying, yes, men can know, yes, men are responsible to know, and God is going to judge them if they do not come to proper conclusion. Romans 1, verses 18 through 20, in fact, tell us that God's deity, his eternal power, are so presented in nature that man is responsible if he doesn't see them. This doesn't necessarily mean that they're so obvious as to be beyond any shadow of doubt, or that everybody must come to this conclusion. In fact, the passage says they don't. But I think it must at least imply that the existence of God is the best explanation for the observed universe. Basically, we would like to pursue that thought in our talk today. We would like to show how God is demonstrated, how God's existence is seen in the universe that exists, how it is the best explanation we know of for the phenomena that we actually see. Imagine we go outside at night and look into the sky. What do we see? Well, if you live too near a city, you may see nothing but a glare of lights, or if it's cloudy, you may see nothing but clouds. But if it's not, you see up into the sky, and you see many, many stars out there. Everywhere we look in the sky in a clear night, we see stars shining. And yet these stars are doing something. These stars are using energy that they have stored in them to make light, and that light is scattering throughout the whole universe. It is carrying energy away from the stars. So the stars are sort of running down, rather like what happens with a watch. You have one of the old wind-up watches. A lot of people now have electric watches. They're running down too. But you have a wind-up watch. You wind it up. You put energy in it. And then it disperses that energy by running the wheels and such, and gradually uses up that energy and stops running. Now, seeing the stars in the sky is something analogous to finding a running watch outdoors somewhere. Suppose you're walking along the road and you find a watch laying by the road and it's running. Without getting into the question of the evidence that the watch gives of a designer and things of that sort, we're not pursuing that particular argument for the existence of God. Suppose you see it running and then you do some experiments on it and you find out that when you wind it all the way up and let it run all the way down, it takes 48 hours to run down. But that when you picked it up, that it took 17 hours, let's say, to run down after you picked it up. Well, then you know that that watch was apparently wound up no more than 31 hours before you found it. 31 plus 17 equals 48 hours. So that watch had to be wound up in the last 31 hours. Now, it's possible that that watch was wound up by some good Samaritan who had come along. He'd seen the watch laying on the ground there. He didn't know who it belonged to. He wasn't going to pick it up and carry it off and take it for his own. And he said, well, maybe the owner will come back and would be distressed to find it not running. I'll wind it up, keep the correct time. That's unlikely, knowing human nature. But even if so, I think you can confidently say that watch was wound up within 31 hours of the time you had picked it up. Possibly it wasn't wound all the way up, so it might not have been so long before you found it. But no more than that. Well, we can say something the same thing when we look at the stars. The stars out there are using up energy. The big stars use energy very rapidly, and so in fact don't have as long a lifetime as the little stars, which use energy very slowly. That would take some more explanation, which I'll not get into. But for each size star, we can estimate by doing computer calculations, not being able to bring the stars into our laboratories or wait for them to burn down. We can do computer calculations and show about how long it takes for the various types of stars to burn down. And therefore, these stars must have gotten started at some finite time in the past. All of them are using a finite amount of energy. None of them have an infinite amount of energy that they're able to draw on. No new fuel is being added to these fires of the stars. They are using up what they've got. Very much like finding a campfire on the beach, for instance, or in a clearing somewhere. We look at the campfire burning, and we see that there's not a lot of ash around, and there's no evidence of, we watch it for a while, there's no evidence of people bringing new wood in, then we see that that fire was lit some finite time in the past, and it's been burning down, and we could probably even calculate it, so it might be a little more complicated to calculate than it would be to figure out how long it takes a watch to run down. This, basically, is the nature of the evidence that we have that suggests that the universe had a beginning. The stars that we see are not infinitely old. There's arguments on how old they are, but I think probably a few billion years for the oldest stars, and even shorter than that for some of the recent stars, suggests that the universe has not always been going on, but that these stars had some sort of a beginning. Now, you're certainly aware that there are many people today who do not believe that this universe had a beginning and things of that variety, and they will offer various explanations for how it can be that the stars are burning down, but that the universe never had a beginning. One of these, sort of a man-on-the-street type explanation you might get from the average village atheist who doesn't understand cosmology or anything of that sort, might be this. Well, we know that all particles move randomly around, and perhaps in the course of time, the stars, which are gradually switching from hydrogen to helium to heavier elements as a star burns down, that somehow, just by chance, these things will break up into pieces again and go back and become hydrogen atoms and start to burn down again. This might be called a chance occurrence, a recycling theory or something like that. I just invented that name, but something like that. Well, we can actually make calculations of how likely something like that is. It's very unlikely. For instance, it's far more likely that if you take your wind-up watch apart and you put the parts in a box and shake them, that they will jump together and become a watch already wound up than it is that the materials in even one star would somehow break apart and simultaneously go back and start a new star or recycle the old star so it burns back down again. Very, very unlikely event. It's in fact far more likely that the room you're sitting in listening to this particular tape, that the air will all move over to one side and leave you to strangle on your side. That's supposedly a random motion of particles as well. And to get all of them over in one place, you can work out the probabilities of it. It's one chance in 10^10^25 that something like that will happen. Or this event supposedly happened in a given room every 10^10^25 seconds. That number's so big I don't know how to explain it. I guess I'll try by saying it's a 1 with 10^25 zeros after it. But how many are 10^25 zeros? Well, 10^25 zeros is a 1 with 25 zeros after it. So it's got that many zeros after that number. We can't even explain it. That many seconds, that many billions of years. Very long, unlikely thing. The result is a person who believes that, when they really are shown what the probability of that is, you really have to say that a person is suppressing the truth. He's desirous of going another way. He doesn't want a God if he is going to go to such lengths to avoid such a thing as creation. Now, however, cosmologists today, many of them, most of them perhaps, do not like the idea of a creation either, but they have more sophisticated ways of trying to avoid this thing, not the idea of just some chance switching of all of the burnt-out material in the star back to unburnt stuff to rework again, but rather another suggestion. Actually, the suggestions that cosmologists have take several forms. We want to look at the two that have probably been most popular in the last 20 or 30 years. The first of these is called the steady-state theory of the universe, and the second is called the oscillating Big Bang universe. Let's look, first of all, at the steady-state theory of the universe. Steady-state theory of the universe was proposed right after World War II by three British cosmologists, Herman Bondi, Fred Hoyle, Thomas Gold. The theory of this universe is that the universe is infinitely big and infinitely old, but stars are burning out all the time. How do you solve that problem? That does make a problem, just as I've stated so far. The problem would be that after some finite time, all the stars would be burnt out. We ought to live in an infinitely big, black, dark universe with nothing burning, but we don't. Well, their explanation is that new matter is coming into existence at every point in space at a very slow rate, and this new matter gets together by gravity and forms new stars and new galaxies, and these new stars burn, and they burn down. You say, well, wait a minute now. Let's see, if we've got an infinite universe, and the stars only last a finite length of time as they burn down, still their burn-up products must stay around somewhere. And so if you're adding new matter all the time and you've got this matter sitting around, it ought to start getting crowded in the universe, shouldn't it? And so if the universe is infinitely old and infinitely large, There ought to be an infinite amount of matter right around us because it's been dumping matter in all the time. We ought to be in an infinitely dense area where we are, whereas in fact I can wave my hand in front of my face and I can walk and such, and it's apparently not infinitely dense around us. Now, you're right about that. The cosmologists Bondi, Hoyle, and Gold suggested that the universe is expanding all the time, and so this matter that's burnt out is moving away from us, and new matter is coming into existence around us and starting new stars. And if we were at any other point in the universe, the same thing would be happening. The matter would be, older matter would be moving away from us, and new matter coming into existence right where we are, and right over there, and right over here, etc. So, we say, well, wait a minute now. Here we've got a universe, and where's all this stuff going? It's going out there, point out either any direction you like to. And the trick you get into here is because this thing is infinite, it kind of boggles the mind, but basically, there's an infinite places for the stuff to go. So our universe would be expanding in all directions and expanding at just the right rate that the amount of matter in any given area is about the same all the time. What would this universe look like? Well, you would look at the galaxies and such around you, and they would be moving away from one another. And indeed, we live in such a universe that looks that way, but that, of course, was already known before this theory was proposed, and other theories have been proposed to explain that. But this theory proposes that these galaxies are moving away from each other, stars are moving away from each other, and new matter is coming in to form new stars, and there will always be some stars burning. They're the stuff that's made up of matter that has come in the last few billion years and still hasn't burned out yet. Well, that is a theory, then, of Fred Hoyle and Thomas Gold and Hermann Bondi, the so-called steady-state theory of the universe. It's called steady-state because the amount of matter in the universe in any given volume is not increasing. The amount that flows out of that volume as its area expands is replaced by new matter coming into existence inside it. This particular theory predicted that if you look with big telescopes in all directions of space, the universe ought to look about the same in all directions and at all times. And basically the theory was proposed in 1948 and was very popular with many cosmologists because it seemed to be so philosophically satisfying. The theory proposed that there was never a beginning, that the laws were built into the universe, that there wouldn't be an end, that you didn't have to worry about a god or a creator or a judgment or anything of that variety. Well, the big problem that the steady-state theory began to face as time went on was that it did not fit the data. The theory predicted that as you look in all directions in space, since the density is about the same, and since the relative percentage of young matter and medium matter and old matter and such is about the same, you ought to have the same type of objects everywhere in space at every time. But as more and more cosmological studies were done, it became apparent that the more distant areas, the areas where we're looking further back into the past, because light takes time to get from there to our telescopes, that in fact it looked like there was more matter at ancient times in the past, in a given volume, than there is today. And this showed up somewhat with galaxies, but showed up especially strongly with a new type of object that was discovered called the quasar, the quasi-stellar object. Don't know what they are for sure, but they're very bright, they're very small, and most of them are very far away, and in fact you can find there are many more of these things in a given volume of space way back in the past, that is, way away from us, than there are close by. And so that began to sort of cause a problem for the steady-state theory of the universe. Likewise, a problem began to be caused by another discovery that had been made by two men named Penzias and Wilson. These men just got a Nobel Prize for their discovery just a few years ago, though the discovery was made 20, 30 years ago. So the discovery was that if you take a radio telescope and point it at the sky in all directions, day or night, the sky looks gray. Does not look black like it does with an optical telescope. Optical telescope looks black with stars in it. Radio telescope, it looks gray with stars in it, let's say. Okay? Very different. Well, the steady-state theory had no simple explanation for this particular problem, but a competitor theory, the Big Bang theory, of which are several varieties, had a built-in explanation for this problem, and that was that the universe was once very tightly packed together. All the matter was packed together very tightly, and it has expanded from that in a kind of an explosion, a big bang. Big Bang occurred some billions of years ago, and the flash, the radiation from that bang, should still be around, and it ought to be of such a nature as to cause the sky to look gray through a radio telescope. Well, these things then eventually led Hoyle, at least among the proponents of the steady-state theory, to abandon his theory. And in 1965, he came out with another theory that he had been wrong all this time, made quite a splash in even the popular news at that time, that he had been wrong all these years, but that he now had a new theory. His new theory was not to go over to a Big Bang theory, which was the major, competitor for his steady-state theory. It was really to say that he was wrong, that the universe looks about the same in all directions. Instead, we're in a section that is expanding, but if you looked in other places beyond the range of our telescopes, you would see parts that were collapsing, and that the universe is really in a different kind of a steady state, and we'll never be able to build telescopes to show this. So Hoyle did not give up his belief that the universe has no beginning. He did not give up his belief that the matter is created by natural processes, which was necessary to a steady-state theory. But he did change to another theory because the data was against his earlier view. And yet he did not change to a creation theory, though the evidence favored that particular thing. Hoyle explains why he did not switch over to creation theory in his book called Galaxy Nuclei and Quasars, Galaxies, Nuclei and Quasars, published in 1965. He says he doesn't like universes that have beginnings, that he has an emotional reaction against such things. And to him, such a universe is very unsatisfying. It's like a car you have to tinker with all the time to keep it running. And the idea he uses is that all the features of the universe are built into it. There's nothing outside tampering with it. And that's a shortcut he uses. Never spends any time investigating any other cosmological theories that require beginnings or something outside tampering with it. Well, I think we see a beautiful example here of a person who is suppressing the truth. He does not like a certain type of solution, therefore he won't spend any time investigating it. Though, as we will suggest, this particular theory that he won't spend any time investigating really fits the data better than his own. Well, let's look next at the other alternative, which has been held rather widely, and since Hoyle changed his view, has probably become the dominant view among cosmologists, a variety of the Big Bang theory called the oscillating Big Bang theory. There are several varieties of the Big Bang theory. All of them agree that some billions of years ago, there was a great explosion from which our universe is presently expanding. And the disagreement of these various models is what happened at the explosion or before the explosion. One cosmologist named Lemaître suggested that the universe was created by God at that point, a creation model. He was Roman Catholic background and obviously was familiar with the biblical material. Another theory explained that before this Big Bang, the universe had been contracting. And George Gamow has suggested that the universe had contracted only once in all of its history, bounced a few billion years ago, 10, 15, 20 billion years ago, and then is it going to expand forever from that point? That has been held by some cosmologists, but was not very popular, because it really means that you only go through this life, if you like, that is, having planets with stars shining on them and life on it and things of that sort. You only go through that once, no repetitions, and that would mean we live in a very unique time in the history of the universe in which there's life. There wasn't any life only a few billion years ago. A few billion years from now, there probably won't be any life, although there's an infinite amount of time before that, and there'll be an infinite amount of time after that. Most cosmologists prefer what they would call an oscillating Big Bang theory, in which the universe expands and then contracts and expands and contracts. Every time it contracts, it smashes back down to neutrons and protons, all of the matter that had existed in the previous cycle of the universe, and has a Big Bang. Then the Big Bang, it expands from that explosion, and new galaxies form, new stars form, new planets form, and since these men are evolutionists, life forms on certain of the planets, and maybe intelligent life on certain of the planets. And then finally, the universe its stars begin to run down, the universe itself has gotten to expand as it's going to, it begins to fall back together again, smashes all this stuff back together, down like a great recycling planet in the sky, you know, a very relevant theory here, and start all over again. Well, that, I would say, is the cosmology that is presently preferred by most cosmologists, but it, too, has some very serious problems. One problem is that the theoreticians who have studied the balance that would be necessary in this theory, that you've got to have a balance in this theory. You've got a contracting universe, and then at the Big Bang, you actually have a big bounce. It's got to stop contracting and start expanding. The theoreticians who have studied this particular problem find a very serious matter. Namely, they know of no way to get a contracting universe like that to bounce. Certainly not one that would get the matter close enough together to form a flash Big Bang like you have that would produce the gray sky to the radio telescopes. Robert Dickey, who did a certain amount of research in this area and is also a respected theoretician, professor at Princeton, remarks in his book, Gravitation in the Universe, page 66, "It's ironical that owing to theoretical difficulties, the original motivation for our work on cosmic black body radiation, that is the gray sky that radio telescopes see, is now somewhat in question. It's long been known that the cosmological equations cannot be integrated through the collapse of the universe to show the existence of a balance leading to the start of a new expansion. A mathematical singularity develops in the solution. It had been thought that this singularity was due to the over-idealized nature of the physical assumptions. It was hoped that the singularity would disappear if sufficient irregularity was introduced into the mathematical model. This has not occurred, and at present, then, the situation is we don't know of any way of getting around this problem. One cosmologist, in fact, Robert Jastrow, has pointed out that from Einstein's theory that energy and mass are different varieties of the same thing, that if you imagine any force that would be strong enough to push the universe apart so it would start to expand, that force would have a sufficient mass that gravity acting on that mass would cause the thing to pull together even tighter. So what we really have to say is that on the basis of any kind of physics we know about, there's no way to make a contracting universe stop contracting and start expanding. Well, that messes up very seriously, then, any kind of theory that has to have a big bounce instead of a big bang, any kind of theory in which the universe did not begin at the explosion, but has always existed and the explosion was just the last of some sequence of cycles or something like that. Likewise, there's a problem on the other end in this model that the universe, as it's expanding, if you're going to have a oscillating model, it's got to stop expanding and start falling back together again. And this, whether this will happen or not depends basically upon how powerful the explosion is relative to how much mass there is. If the explosion is powerful enough, it will just drive the pieces off in all directions forever. They'll never come back. But if it's weak enough, it will drive them out a certain distance and it will fall back. It's like throwing a ball up in the air. If you throw a ball up in the air at 100 miles an hour, it's going to come back again and maybe hit you in the head, maybe hit the ground, something like that. If you throw it up at 8 or 10 miles a second, it's not going to come back again. It's going to fly right on off the Earth. Since we're not able to throw balls that hard, we're not used to that situation. But, of course, our space program has shown that you can launch objects at a high enough speed eventually to get them away from the Earth and they don't come back. As, for instance, the various probes we sent out to Saturn and Venus, Venus would do, Mars, Jupiter, and such. So the problem here, then, is on both ends, the oscillating Big Bang cosmology really doesn't seem to work. On the one end, we can't find any force that will make the universe stop contracting and start expanding. On the other end, we know what kind of force would stop it from expanding and start contracting, enough gravity, enough mass, but our studies indicate that so far we haven't found even 1% that amount of mass. I think of an article that appeared in Science News back in July 9th, 1977, where a rocket had been sent up above our atmosphere to look at various distant objects in the ultraviolet, the so-called quasars, look at one of the quasars in the ultraviolet, to see how much matter lies between us and that quasar, how much gas there is in space. And turns out that there's nowhere near enough to stop the universe from contracting. What you have to say today, then, is there's not enough visible matter, not enough shining stars to pull it back. There's not enough invisible matter in the form of gas spread through space. The only alternative left that might stop the universe from expanding and allow it to start contracting would be matter that's hidden, like in black holes or something of that sort. What we really come up with, then, after all of this discussion, is that of the theories that have been proposed for the nature of the universe, the only one that fits the data that we have today is a universe in which there was a beginning to the universe, that is, it didn't exist before that time, back at the time of the Big Bang. Any universe which is supposed to have always existed does not fit the data of the shining of the stars, the expansion of the universe, and things of this variety. I've tried to give you a quick sketch here, and a sketch of something that's very technical, and yet tried to explain it in non-technical terms, but trying to show you that on the very boundaries of our study of cosmology, what our universe is like and how it got started and such, we have evidence for a beginning, evidence for a beginner, but people do not want to hear that particular type of thing. The cosmologists don't like the idea. This fellow Robert Jastrow that I mentioned recently, professor at Columbia and at Dartmouth, and the director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York City, has written a book called God and the Astronomers just a couple years ago. And he has some very juicy quotations in which astronomers see what the evidence points toward and they don't like it. They don't like the idea of a beginning of a universe. Well, the upshot of all of this is astronomy, something that seems to be a way out there sort of subject, actually comes home to us with a very down-to-earth message. It's as though we were sitting outside and someone dropped a meteor in our lap. The heavens are telling us that they haven't always existed, that there is a work of someone else, that there is a creator. Well, I've given you a quick sketch of that, but trying to show you that it is wrong to say that we can't know anything about these matters, that it's just a leap in the dark, but rather there is real evidence in the nature of our universe that it's a created universe. We've only looked at one area. We've not looked at design. We've not looked at the complexity of life and how life seems to show not only a causation but planning, design, things of that variety. That would be a very interesting subject. We've looked at just the one area of the nature of our universe in regard to the star shining and how that points to a beginning. What we'd like to do now is take an imaginary tour of the universe, because if the universe is a created thing, then, as the Bible says, the nature of this universe tells us something about God. It will tell us a number of things about God. I want to say a word about these before we start, and then mention them as we travel on our journey. The size of the universe will tell us something about the size of God, in a sense. Not that a person can't build something bigger than himself. We do that all the time, although, of course, we build it out of things that we did not cause to come into existence. But the universe is something that is lesser than God, and therefore its huge size should cause us to realize that we really are not all that big, that great thing, that the God who has made these things must be far more important than we are, and we ought to pay attention to what he's doing. We'll see in the power of the universe that God is the one with the infinite and eternal power far beyond these things, because he made them and keeps them going. Infinite doesn't mean much to us. But when we begin to see how big is, then we can get some idea that God is even bigger than that. Also want to look a little bit at God's provision for our survival on Earth. Many people like to think that this world we're in is a pretty bad place. And indeed, man has messed some things up pretty thoroughly. But this world we're in is still a very good place. It's still very nicely designed to be able to support life and to make that life be something that planning joy and these sorts of things can actually take place in. We want to see something of the order that exists in the universe, the unity that exists in the universe. Well, let's imagine then that we're going to take a trip through the cosmos to view what we can say about the universe. Well, let's imagine we get in a spaceship then, and we take off. And we don't have to go up very far before man begins to become insignificant already. If you're up only a mile or so above the Earth, taking pictures with a normal camera, you'll find that you can see evidence of man's activity. You can see highways, you can see fields, you can see buildings and things of that sort. But it's very hard to see people. You'll have to go up a mile or so before you really can't see people. And by the time you go up 100 miles, it's almost impossible to see anything man has made. If you're taking nighttime pictures in good weather, you can see light from the cities. But otherwise, at 100 miles up, there are very, very few things that man has made that actually show up. Pictures, thousands of pictures were taken from about 100 miles up early in the space program by a weather satellite. The satellite was not built to take pictures at night, just daytime, mainly looking for cloud cover and such. But men who are interested in studying whether there's life on other planets or not decided it would be nice to go through these pictures and see whether there was any evidence of life on this planet. We know there's life on this planet. We think there's intelligent life on this planet. Some people wonder. And here is a chance to look and see whether there's any evidence of it. They looked through thousands and thousands of photographs. They found one picture that gave evidence of intelligence, and it turned out to be the work of a lumbering company in Canada. They had cut out a section of lumber in a crisscross pattern, and it was visible from 100 miles up. Everything else, because they couldn't take night pictures, everything else of man's was invisible on that particular, on those thousands of pictures. Well, so already at 100 miles up, man is pretty insignificant. If you, instead of looking straight down at the Earth, you look over at the horizon of the Earth, you see something very scary. You see that we live on an Earth that's 8,000 miles through, top to bottom, right through the center. But the part that we can live in is a very, very thin skin on the outside of that. We can live in the atmosphere. If you don't get too high up in it, even on the top of Mount Everest at 29,000 feet, you're up too high for people to do anything, and up too high for people to survive unless they have had considerable training in breathing rather thin air. But that's less than 6 miles above the surface. And you don't have to go, you can't go down very far into the Earth before the pressures become too heavy for people to stand. The deepest mines are about a mile. So you've got a shell, let's say 8 miles thick. That's actually exaggerated slightly, but about 8 miles thick on a ball 8,000 miles thick. Well, that's like the paint on a golf ball or the thin brown skin on an onion, something like that. Man's habitat that he can safely function in without having all kinds of elaborate paraphernalia such as one has to have for a spacewalk is 1,000th the thickness of the Earth he lives on. Just this thin shell. Of course, it's good that it spreads over a good bit of area on the surface, but very, very thin shell. So already we can see something of a man's smallness, and we can also see something of the fragile habitat he is in. If something happened to mess up that habitat, if volcanoes started going off everywhere on Earth, let's not say everywhere on Earth, many of them on Earth, and started clouding up that so that we didn't get enough sun, that would foul things up. Or messed up the air so we couldn't breathe it, that would foul things up. Wouldn't have to be too much done to the little area we live in, and we wouldn't be able to survive. Very scary sort of thing. And yet, men have survived for at least thousands of years on this planet. God has designed a planet that operates in such a way that these hazards have not occurred and are very limited in extent where they do occur, such as volcanic explosions and things of that variety. Well, let's go out from the Earth then to our nearest neighbor, the Moon. Now, the Moon, until the space age, we could only visit in our imagination. We could only look at through telescopes and take good pictures through telescopes and see what we could see there. And with the best telescopes that were built before the space age, we could see that the Moon was round like our planet, that it had mountains on its surface, and Galileo thought it had seas at one time, but it was pretty quickly apparent as they built little better telescopes than his rather primitive ones that there were objects in these seas that looked like rings, and they weren't ripples from a pebble being thrown in the sea because they stayed the same size all the time. These are what we call the craters. And so a picture that showed the mountains and the craters and that with perhaps the smallest objects you could see on it, maybe a mile or two across. They were the best pictures we had of the Moon before the space age began. But then, in the 60s, as the U.S. was able to build devices heavy enough to get men not only up above our atmosphere, but out towards the moon, began to get far better pictures as we began to send unmanned ships to land on the moon, began to get better pictures. And so began to see that not only were there these large craters on the moon, but there were very small craters, the most magnified pictures we could take from these ships out in space, which still showed craters all the way down as small size scale as you could see. When man finally landed on the moon in 1969 and climbed down onto the surface, he found, indeed as had been suspected, as it was actually certain, I would say, a land with no air, no atmosphere. The picture which you may have seen of the astronaut standing with the American flag flowing out in front of him needs to be examined very carefully. The flag has actually got a metal rod running across the top to make it stand out. So it's not a wind blowing there on the moon, but instead we have a picture of an airless surface, something that cannot support human life except for the very complicated equipment that man brings with himself. When you look at a picture of the astronaut, you see, first of all, he's got something over his face. And that stuff he's got over his face is so that he can have air where he is breathing, and that oxygen and other necessary gases are supplied then to allow him to breathe. And he's got something all over him, all over his skin, hands, feet, etc. Very heavy spacesuit. That has a couple purposes. One, even if he had something over his head, he could not go out in a vacuum with his skin uncovered, because immediately the water in his cells would start to boil at that pressure, and he would all come to pieces, things of that sort. So he's got to be inside this pressure suit to keep himself from being fatally damaged. The suit also has another advantage. It protects him from the temperature. The temperature is quite hot on the surface of the moon during daytime, which is when our astronauts were there. Temperature is up in the 200s during the daytime. And if he should stay there at night, they drop to 200 below zero. We're talking about Fahrenheit scale. So big, big changes. They didn't stay there at night. Those huge changes in temperature on the moon don't occur on the Earth because we've got an atmosphere to keep the temperature from changing as rapidly. Our atmosphere gives us something to breathe. It keeps temperatures from changing rapidly so we can survive. Also, it does something else very important. When we look on the moon, we find that even the little rocks moon rocks, even a few inches across, you'll see them filled with craters. And if you look at these moon rocks with a microscope, you'll see that they're craters even on the microscopic scale. In fact, if you take the moon dust that was brought back from the moon, and you look at little pieces of dust under the microscope, you'll see they've got craters on them. You see, the moon has no atmosphere, and so the meteors that are out in space, very small particles of dust and the pebbles and big rocks and boulders, etc., they come bombing into the moon and smash onto it at speeds from anywhere from maybe 10 miles per second to 40 miles a second. That is 10 to 40 times the speed of a rifle bullet. And so even the little dust particles make craters, small craters, in the surface. Now, for an astronaut, those things make small craters in a spacesuit, which do not go through unless the meteors were big. And providentially, no big meteors arrived where the astronauts were standing anytime they were on there. Then, of course, the big ones would be very, very rare, but the dust is quite frequent. Now, that same dust, those same pebbles and rocks and boulders, are hitting the Earth every day, too. But the Earth has got an atmosphere. And so the dust and the small pebbles, they all burn up in the upper atmosphere. So by the time they get down to about 100 miles, they have burned up into ash, and the ash floats slowly down and settles under your bed as dust. Actually, some of that dust is from other sources, but some of the dust that occurs on the Earth is due to meteorites. Big meteors will come all the way to the surface of the Earth and make craters, but there are very few of those, and so that's a relatively rare happening. So our atmosphere on Earth, something that is completely lacking on the moon, provides breathing, provides protection from temperature changes. It provides protection from the meteorites. It likewise provides protection from certain types of radiation from the sun that don't make it to the surface because of materials in our atmosphere that absorb it, very strong ultraviolet radiation from the sun, which would be very damaging to our body if stopped as well. So just visiting our nearest neighbor, we can see one that God has provided a habitat that is very safe, quite different than that of the moon. Let's think now about the nearest planet to us that we can see the surface of. The moon is considered a satellite or moon of our planet. The various planets have moons around them, 30-some known now. But the first separate planet then, which is by itself, so to speak, is would either be the planet Venus or the planet Mars. Venus gets a little closer to us, but because it's thick cloud cover, we can't see anything. Mars, we can actually see the surface. And yet the best pictures that we had of Mars before the beginning of the space age were not very good. You could tell that Mars had polar caps, that is ice caps, or some kind of frost material on the north and south poles, that it had some type of color changes on its surface during the year. Some people claim to have seen canals, sort of little straight line objects, but they never showed up on pictures. And it was, of course, known that it's possible to see things with the naked eye that a picture cannot capture because the pictures had to be exposed over a few seconds, whereas the eye is able to capture details that change more rapidly than that, and the air in our atmosphere changes enough to make it hard to see details. So it really wasn't known whether there was anything to the canals or not. Many people were skeptical, but really was not known until the space age began. When they began to send out probes toward Mars, where they could get very close compared with what we are here, and could take pictures that had much more resolution than anything we could take, and didn't have to worry about our atmosphere mucking things up, it became apparent that the canals were apparently figments of the imagination of the early observers. We do know the human eye can play tricks on you, can connect dots and things like that, particularly when they're near the edge of the ability to see. And so the bigger photographs show that indeed there were no things corresponding to canals, and as the bigger and better photographs were arranged, we observed that there were craters on the surface of Mars, and then finally we landed a Viking lander on the planet and was able to see what it looked like. We found out it had pink sky, not because its sky wouldn't normally look blue otherwise, but because the ground was very orange rock, and the sunlight off of that orange rock made the sky look pink. The ground looks like a really desert area in this country. Arid, no water, no plants growing, just rock sitting there in the midst of fields, so sort of a soil with rocks sitting in it. Very desolate looking place. Mars does have an atmosphere, and so its sky looks pink instead of black, as its sky would look on the moon. This atmosphere moderates the temperature, so that the temperature on Mars, though it's far, much further away from the sun than the moon is, and than the Earth is relatively pleasant compared with the moon. The low temperatures perhaps reach maybe 100 below zero, not too nice, but still not absurd. And the high temperatures get perhaps above freezing at the equator in the summer at midday, but certainly a more pleasant range of temperatures due to the atmosphere. You don't have to worry about meteorites making little pock marks in, say, your watch crystals or something like that, because the atmosphere blocks those things off. But your big trouble with the planet Mars is that it's the wrong kind of atmosphere. It doesn't have any oxygen in it. Or the oxygen it does have in it is in a compound called CO2, which we cannot breathe. So Mars, a planet that is like Earth in some ways, a little smaller, but a place where human life could not exist without considerable amount of technological devices to function with. You'd have to have an oxygen supply. You'd have to have some way of keeping yourself warm enough. It would be very hard to build anything that would fly in that atmosphere as well, either. It's very thin. So we see that Mars, which probably has the best environment of any other planet in the solar system besides the Earth, I think there's no question about that now, still is not very good. Could not support man without bringing his own oxygen with him or finding out a way of manufacturing it from the materials of the ground or from the materials of the atmosphere. Was wondered for a long time whether there was life on Mars. Early in the century, it was suggested that life was so likely on Mars that it would be no big deal if people found it there. In fact, a large prize was offered for the first person to contact life from any other planet, but Mars was accepted from the contest because it would be too easy to find it there. Well, even when the Viking probe was sent from Earth out to Mars, there were some people who felt it was so likely that there would be life out there that they didn't want to take any chances on contaminating it. They're very careful to sterilize all of the equipment that was sent out, and they in fact sent experiments to test for life on Mars. At first, it appeared that a couple of these experiments were indicating the presence of life, but because one crucial experiment did not give any indication of life, the one that looked for the complicated molecules, it's now felt that probably all that was going on is that the surface of Mars has got a great deal of oxygen in it in the form of peroxides, and these things were reacting to produce oxygen under certain circumstances that was mistaken for some type of life that would be producing oxygen. So now it's generally felt, though it's not beyond question, that there is no life of any sort on Mars. Well, that much about Mars, one of our nearest neighbors, and certainly the best alternative habitat. You might wonder why I speak about Mars as being the best alternative in our solar system, because after all, Venus is closer to us, it's near the same size planet, it's not so close to the Sun that it should be enormously hot, and many people have in fact pictured Venus as a place of lush jungles and oceans and things of that variety. Well, when you actually visit Venus, nobody has done it in person, but we have sent probes there, the Russians have sent probes there, find out that it has such a cloud cover, such a thick atmosphere, that it is far hotter than it would normally be for the distance it is from the Sun. At that distance from the Sun, you might think it might be up in the 100s somewhere or something, 100, 150, something like that. But in fact, the atmosphere is so thick, the temperature is about 900 degrees on the surface, and the atmospheric pressure is about 100 times that on our Earth. Besides that, the atmosphere itself is made up of a sulfuric acid gas and would be very detrimental to anything. So it's now pretty well conceded that no life as we know it exists on the planet Venus. Let's move on then out to the biggest planet in our solar system, the star performer, so to speak, other than the Sun, the planet Jupiter. Jupiter, we have just begun to visit now, have been able to see something of its great red spot and the huge cloud formations in it. Yet Jupiter is no place you'd want to live. The temperatures are very cold in the upper areas of it, and then when you get down to a place where the temperatures are reasonable, the pressures are so high, you could not stand. It's got a very heavy gravity because it's a large planet. It's cold on the outer parts because it's far from the Sun. The material out of which the atmosphere is made is not the sort of thing we can survive on. The planets it's got around it don't look very promising. Two of them are sort of like big snowballs and apparently largely made of ice. Another one is largely made of sulfur and has big sulfur volcanoes spewing out stuff on the surface all the time. Yet we begin to see something of the size of our universe as we look at the planet Jupiter, a planet that compared with our Earth is as much bigger as a basketball is than a marble. So something of the vast size is seen even there without looking at the vast size of our solar system itself. Well, let's come back to think about our Sun rather than visiting further through our solar system. The Sun is, after all, in many ways the most important member of our solar system. I suppose we would think the Earth is more important, and there's some sense in which it is. If the Earth wasn't here, I guess we wouldn't be. But if the Sun weren't here, the Earth wouldn't be either, I think, or at least it would not be livable. The Sun provides our heat that we're able to survive with, and it turns out enormous amounts of energy. We think of the most powerful thing man has ever built, I suppose, would be one of the large hydrogen bombs. The largest hydrogen bomb the Russians have ever exploded are about 50 megaton hydrogen bombs. That's not that they weigh 50 megatons, 50 million tons, but the explosive power of these bombs is equal to 50 million tons of TNT. Now, the energy output of our Sun, an average star, is equal to 2 billion of these 50 megaton hydrogen bombs per second. And we think of the energy problems we're having on Earth with the oil, the results it has on our electric bills and gas bills and these other things. But here's an enormous amount of energy provided for us. We just have to figure out how to use it. And it shows us a little bit of the power of God, too. Here's man, most powerful thing he's ever built, 50 megaton hydrogen bomb, and yet here's God, a star he has created, turning out 2 billion times that much energy per second. This energy output then causes an enormous amount of heat near the sun. The distance, you have to be away the distance we are to avoid being overheated on the one hand or being too cold on the other hand. The energy output then forms this heat array going out from the sun, from very hot near the sun to very cold beyond. We live in the middle of what is called the life zone. A zone in which if you put a planet out there and allow it to heat up from the sun on the one side and radiate in all directions to cool off, reaches a balanced temperature, that on the inside of this life zone, the temperature will be that of boiling water, and on the outside of this life zone, the temperature will be that of freezing water. So to have water in a usable liquid state, you have to be inside this life zone. In our solar system, there are only 3 planets in the life zone. Mercury near the inside edge, but not really in the life zone because of its thick atmosphere drives the temperature way up higher. Mars near the outside edge of the life zone, but because its thin atmosphere only rarely has a temperature where water would be liquid, and because of its thin atmosphere, even then, the water doesn't become liquid. It switches immediately from frozen to gas, just like dry ice does in our planet. Only the Earth in our solar system is the sort of thing that will support human life. Well, let's move out beyond our solar system to view some more of the universe, because our solar system is just next door compared with the size of the universe. We haven't talked much about distances yet, but 8,000 miles from one side of the Earth to the other, if you go through, of course longer now if you have to go around, the distance from the Earth to the Sun is 93 million miles, and the distance out to the most distant planet in our solar system would be something like 40 times that. But now we want to talk about really big distances compared with that. We've been talking in terms of thousands and millions of miles there. Now we've got to talk in terms of trillions of miles. And so astronomers don't normally like to get tangled up with things like that. They use a unit of measurement that's very large. And one of these common units of measurement they use is the so-called light year. Light year is the distance light travels in a year. It's 6 trillion miles about. And to measure the distance to other stars, we use light years. The nearest star to us, besides the Sun, is about 4 light years away. So that's the kind of numbers we're going to be talking about now. Big, big numbers, 6 trillion miles per light year, and yet 4 of those to get out to any other star but our own sun. Well, let's look out at the stars. Naturally, stars by themselves are not too exciting to look at, or at least the kind of views we can get of them from the Earth. Only the sun can we get a very close-up view of from the Earth. All the other stars, when you look at them through a telescope, they look like a point, although you can build particular devices of a complicated sort to measure the size of a few of these stars, but they just don't look like much. So most of the exciting pictures you've seen out in astronomy books and things of that sort that are not of the planets or the sun, they are of other objects in the sky. Some stars are very hot stars. They're throwing off a lot more energy than our star is. A star like that may have a ring of gas around it if it has the right kind of neighborhood to it. These particular stars are putting out so much energy that the gas that is around them, whether it's a cloud they're in or whether it's a gas that they themselves have shot out, this gas is ionized, it glows, and this is caused because the light from that star is ripping the electrons off the gas nearby. Now, all of us are familiar with ionized gas, whether we know it or not, because we've all seen a fluorescent light. A fluorescent light picture has got ionized gas inside of it. You don't see that really glowing. You see the paint on the inside of the tube glowing. Most of us have seen neon lights as well, as used for advertising signs and things like that. There you're actually seeing the gas glowing. The red is neon, and various other colors, other types of gases that are glowing. Well, some stars are so hot compared with our sun, often thousands of degrees hotter than our sun, that they can cause the gas around them to glow like this. A star like that, that's some thousands of degrees hotter than our sun, might be putting out 100 times as much energy as the sun. So instead of putting out 2 billion 50 megaton hydrogen bombs of energy per second, they're putting out 200 billion 50 megaton hydrogen bombs per second. And there are a lot of stars out there. We can show many pictures of star fields where there are hundreds or thousands of stars out there, and each star on the average has the energy of our star, 2 billion 50 megaton hydrogen bombs per second. There are stars that are weaker than our star, there are stars that are brighter than our star, but our star, the Sun, is rather average. Well, these stars sometimes blow up. These are called novas or supernovas. When a star, something happens to that star, it causes it to blow up. I'm not going to try and describe what it is that happens to it. We think now we have some ideas of what's involved. It has something to do with the star using up its readily available energy and starting to collapse. And then when it collapses, that brings new fuel into a place where it can burn, but it brings it in so quickly it explodes. That produces an exploding star. Why I mention exploding stars, though, is they're a good example of an enormous energy source. A star that instead of taking billions of years to use, say, 10 or 15% of its energy, they'll use it all in a year, all that 10 or 15% in a year. One of the stars that can still be seen in the sky is called the Crab Nebula. And when you look at it through a telescope, you see it doesn't look like a star at all. It looks like a big splotch of glowing stuff. It's the remains of a star that blew up in 1054 AD. That is, the light from explosion reached us in 1054 AD. So it's been exploding now for over 900 years, and yet the gas in that explosion is still moving away from the center at 600 miles a second. And the energy output of that star in that 1 year was, say, a billion times what it would be for our star in a year. So in a second, a star like that would be putting out something like a billion times a billion 50 megaton hydrogen bombs per second instead of just a billion times. Well, those numbers are already getting up where we can hardly imagine how big they are. And yet this is something which God, who is more powerful, made this energy, put it in these stars, and controls them in such a way that these things happen. We want to go on now from our stars inside our so-called galaxy to look at our galaxy itself. The word galaxy is just a Greek word that means something like Milky Way, and that's our English name for the same object, the Milky Way. A galaxy is the name for a large cluster of stars from anywhere from perhaps a few million to several hundred billion stars that are all rotating around each other in the form of sometimes a sphere, sometimes a football shape, or sometimes a sort of a flat pinwheel shape. Our particular Milky Way galaxy is rotating in sort of a flat pinwheel shape. The galaxy is enormous. It is 100,000 light years from one edge to the other. It looks kind of like a pair of marching band symbols put face to face, except it's made up of stars, not of bronze or whatever in a band symbol. And these stars are all rotating around the common center. Our particular galaxy has somewhere between 100 and 200 billion stars. The exact number is not known. And on the average, they're like our sun. So the output of our galaxy is 100 or 200 billion times 2 billion 50 megaton hydrogen bombs per second. Size 100,000 light years across, or 100,000 times 6 trillion miles. So in our galaxy, a bigger than average galaxy, we get a little more feel, a little more awed by the enormous size, the enormous power of our universe. But there are other galaxies beyond our own. Most of them nearby are smaller. But one of them, Andromeda Galaxy, about 2 million light years away. Notice the enormous distances we're talking about now, and yet we're still nearby as regards other galaxies. That galaxy is maybe half again as big as ours. Perhaps it's 200 or 300 billion stars in it. So something of the size there. And yet there's galaxy after galaxy out there with millions or hundreds of millions or billions or even hundreds of billions of stars in them. One galaxy that's not too far away gives us a picture of something that represents some sort of an energy source that really staggers the imagination. This is a irregular galaxy. It appears through our constellation, the Big Dipper. It's not in the Big Dipper. It's actually beyond it, obviously. the Big Dipper just nearby stars for us. But this irregular galaxy turns out to be blowing up in the middle. And you can not see this when you just take a regular photograph of it. But if you take a photograph of this galaxy where you only allow the light from one particular frequency to come through your telescope by using a filter, you can see this plume of gas blowing out of the center of this galaxy. We do not know what the source of this energy is, but it's such a large energy source that it must have something to do with converting matter directly into energy or something of that variety. Einstein's formula, which you've probably heard of, E equals MC squared, tells the relationship between energy and mass. And the number C, which is multiplied by itself, C squared is C times C, is a very big number. So it means a little bit of mass makes a lot of energy. Well, apparently, a lot of mass is being turned into energy in the center of this particular galaxy. Whether stars are colliding with one another and annihilating, producing huge amounts of energy, whether matter and antimatter are annihilating each other in this galaxy, or whether there's a black hole in the center of this galaxy that is pulling matter into itself, and when it pulls the stuff in, some of it in falling gives off a lot of energy, we don't know. But something drastic like that is happening. And a galaxy like this might be putting out hundreds of times as much energy, at least in its center part, that compared with an equivalent number of stars, enormous energy sources. Well, turning away from energy for a moment to size, our galaxy is quite big, as we mentioned, something like 100,000 light years across. But as we look out into the space around us, we see enormous distances involved. We can see places where there are galaxies still visible to us at 10 million, 50 million, and 100 million light years away. By the time we get up to about 600 million light years away, we get to the place where we can't see galaxies anymore. Our biggest telescopes with the best films cannot detect galaxies anymore. The galaxies are too dim. And out beyond that distance, the only thing we can see are these so-called quasars. We don't know what they are. They're very powerful. They're producing energy, much more energy than an average galaxy is producing. So we see, again, something of the great power in our universe, and we see something of the great distances. We don't know the exact distances of these quasars, but numbers like 10 billion light years are frequently spoken of. 10 billion times 6 trillion miles. The number of galaxies we don't know either, but we can see again and again pictures that have, photographs that have maybe 50 or 100 galaxies in them, and we can add up these various pictures and estimate that there are probably several billion, maybe even 100 billion galaxies within the range of our telescopes. And if galaxies continue out beyond that, there are at least 1,000 times that many out to the range of the farthest quasars we can see. We're talking about trillions and trillions of galaxies containing billions of stars putting out energy at 2 billion 50 megaton hydrogen bombs per second on the average. Well, what we've done then in making this tour of the universe is to show you something of the mind-boggling extent of it. We don't know how big it is. As far as we can see, there are still things out there, still things further away, and about 10 billion light years seems to be the furthest we can see away. But through all this universe, there's a reason for calling it a universe. It has unity to it. We can see that, as far as we can tell, the same physical laws are operating in the most distant galaxies, most distant quasars, as they are right around here. We see order everywhere. We see the physical laws that men have struggled to understand, and which have a certain beauty to them, a complexity to them. We see the enormous size. We see the power involved here, power that goes way beyond anything we can imagine. And we see that God has made a special provision for our survival here on Earth. We do not know that there's no other place in the universe that man might not be able to survive. We do know there's no other place in our solar system, and that's as far as we can even test that particular picture. Well, this tour of the universe, then, should really say something to us personally. Today, men have been using the radio telescopes that have been built for astronomy to try and contact intelligent life out there in the universe. They're spending a fair amount of money on this subject, not enormous amounts, perhaps a few thousands or millions of dollars. They're looking for intelligent life in the universe. They're sending out messages to these supposed intelligent beings out there. There have been a number of sample messages sent out, basically trying to convey some idea of our level of intelligence and do something that that is yet understandable to a person who has entirely different language and such. Whether there would be any success there or not, it's hard to judge. But the ironic thing about this is that although man is looking for intelligent life in the universe, the most intelligent life in the universe has been contacting man for thousands of years, and man doesn't want to hear. God tells us that he made the whole place, that it's very important that we know about him, that he has revealed some very important things about himself that we're not going to find out any other way, and we better pay attention to him. In Deuteronomy 29:29, God tells us the secret things belong to the Lord our God, but those things which are revealed belong to us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law. You see, the Bible is God's communication to mankind. It tells us how we were made and how we're put together and what we need to do to have a life of real fulfillment, a life of real joy, and to be able to satisfy God and to enjoy his blessings. But many men don't like that message. They don't want to hear it. The Bible goes beyond that, too. The Bible tells us that God himself visited this planet one time back in history, and he did it in an unusual way. We think about astronauts coming down in a UFO and landing and getting out and walking around or something. God, whose ways are more subtle than that, actually had himself born as a man and lived on this planet as a man to show us how a life should be conducted that was lived according to his law. And in doing so, he provided the righteousness that we have never been able to provide. Jesus loved God with all his heart and mind and soul. Jesus loved his neighbor like he loved himself, and none of us ever do that. If we trust in Jesus, that righteousness he provided will become our righteousness. Jesus did something more than that, too, because our unwillingness, inability to keep God's law, has built up for us many sins, much guilt. And Jesus himself, in dying on the cross, as God, in a few hours, suffered a punishment that would have taken us forever to suffer. And if we trust in him, the punishment he paid on the cross will take the place of the punishment we deserve. Jesus also pictured God for us, what he's like. John 1:18 says, "No man has seen God at any time." When we look out in the universe, we can see some things about God, but it's not like personally knowing God. But in Jesus Christ, we can personally know God. We can see how he reacted. We can see the love he showed. And in fact, by trusting in him, we can come to personally know him in our own life, to guide our own life. Jesus Christ is the way to know God and the way to be right with God. And yet there are people who say today, "Oh yes, I like to think about Christ, that he's this way. I don't like to think of Christ as the one who would cleanse the temple, who would be angry at the Pharisees, or who is going to judge anybody. I like to think of gentle Jesus, meek and mild, who would never hurt a flea," and things of that variety. The trouble there, the person is making the kind of Jesus they want. They're ignoring the real Jesus. God, in his real goodness and his love, is also a just God. He's not going to treat wickedness, sin, disobedience, and rebellion as though it's all right. And therefore, we must know God as he is. We must know the God of the Bible. We must know the Jesus of the Bible. And that can only be known by reading the Bible and by believing what it says and by trusting its guidance for our life. The God of the Bible is the God who's in control of the universe and therefore in control of history, the one who declares the end from the beginning. From ancient times, he declares the things that haven't occurred yet, saying, "I'm going to do what I want. I'm going to do what pleases me." As the spiritual says, God has got the whole world in his hand. And yet, this God who made the universe, and he's got the whole world in his hand, and who's telling us about himself, through the message that comes to us through the stars, is telling us something very important, something we've been discussing already. The stars burning down, using up their energy. He's telling us it's not going to last forever. This world is not going to last forever. He's telling us something, we're not going to last forever. We're going to succumb to entropy, so to speak, to this using up of energy, to death. He tells us, in fact, this world is passing away. But if you will do the will of God, you will repent, turn back to Jesus, trust in Him, depend upon Him for your acceptance, then you will exist forever. The God who made the universe and who made a laying down universe intentionally has made you that if you will be reconciled to Him, you don't have to worry about running down. You don't have to worry about dying finally. You can realize that you will exist forever, exist in a time, in a situation of joy and love and peace and fulfillment. But that if you continue in your own disobedience, you will be in a condition one day worse than ceasing to exist, a condition of torment, regret, hatred, unfulfillment, and that sort of thing will continue forever. The message of God's Word and the message of His world are the same, though we have far more information in His Word. The message is that these things aren't going to last forever. We've got to make arrangements with God. We've got to find Him and know Him while there's still an opportunity. I trust the Lord will help you to do that today.
Other helpful cassettes are available from Biblical Theological Seminary. For a free copy of our cassette catalog or other information about the seminary, please write to Biblical Theological Seminary, 200 North Main Street, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, zip code 19440.